Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
I am not good with drugs. I have lost my mind so many times. I am the person sitting in the corner that people have to rescue because I'm like kind of weeping or like, can't, like thing. I'm sitting there thinking, I think I need to go to the toilet, but have I just been to the toilet? Or do I need, like, I've completely lost all rational kind of ability.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map. So now that you're going out and you're doing like book events, but you're playing some music as well, right? I understand. How is that to come like full circle and connection with people? Do you enjoy it?
So all the book events I've done, I've been interviewed by completely different people at everything. It just becomes a chat like this is.
Right.
And, you know, I have had like mates going, oh God, have you got another book event? Like, oh, it's quite hard work, isn't it? And I'm like, so isn't. I'm literally sitting there fucking talking about myself for like an hour.
Yeah.
No, it's not hard. And chatting with someone who's being really fucking nice to me and asking me questions, and you know what I mean? Oh, no, it's fucking great.
I do. People ask me the same question and I would say, what's hard about it? I'm going out there talking about a book I wrote about myself. So I know all the things and the questions, the answers to the questions. What's hard about it is great fun. Yeah. But people ask some really, do you ever have like, a Q&A question session with the people at the that have come to see you? Because I did some of those, right. And they're really interesting. I mean, I found after a while there was like three or four questions that people always asked, but then there's some other ones that are like really interesting, different, and they're the most fun part of the whole event, really.
I mean, there is the risk of the question that isn't a question.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. I saw you play, la, 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 this happened to me, da, 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 gets to the end, no question. No. And you're like, okay, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I've had a few of those. I did a thing out in Cleveland at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I did like an event, and they filmed it, and one guy got up and just did exactly that. He just went on this whole sort of description about how he felt about everything and what he'd seen and that, and at the end there was no question. We're just like, okay, next one, you know, that's it, that's all you can do. You can't, what are you going to say to it? You know, it was very funny.
Yeah, well, and we've played a bit of music at some of them, which is a little bit weird. So I can't remember how it... Oh, I tell you what, it came up because the first one I did, which was just before the book was even written, I did a thing at the Social in London and oh, God, Ted said, oh, can you play a bit of music? And I was like, oh, God, all right, okay. So I had a go with a guitar and just sort of talk, and I tried to put something together, and I don't know, you'd have to ask someone who went, but I just thought... It was awful. I mean, it wasn't really, but it was just not my comfort zone. You know, I just don't, I'm not someone who can sit there with a guitar and fucking break into song. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I just thought, if there's going to be a music element, which is nice, then I kind of want it to be a little band. So, you know, Moose, my partner, is playing, and we've got Ollie, who's in on bass. So we're sort of doing this thing. Anyway, we're playing these Lush songs. And again, I feel sort of, it's fine because it's in support of the book. Right. Like, there's a point where it becomes naff, right? If we start doing headline shows and I'm playing Lush songs, then it's like crossing a boundary, right?
Yeah.
So while it's the book, that's fine. Yeah. But I think we're sort of looking at maybe writing, now that we're all in a room together, we might as well start writing stuff. So, but I quite like the nebulousness of it, you know. I'm not very good at talking about things until I'm actually doing them. So I haven't got a lot of detail to give you, but I think one of the liberating things about not being in a massively successful band is that, because you don't earn any fucking money doing it, is that it does mean you can just do what the hell you like, because it doesn't really make any difference. And there isn't that kind of desperate treadmill to keep your profile up and keep the money coming in. So I'm just going to toy with that for a while and see what happens.
As you get older, all of that stuff, you know, that sort of intensity. We were talking with, who do we have on? Terry Nunn about from Berlin. That was like one of our first guests. And she said that she missed all this stuff back in the day because all she was doing was racing to get to the next important thing, you know. And like now we don't have to do that. There's not the pressure to do that, you know. So it kind of liberates you as well.
I mean, it is a bit virtue out of necessity. I don't want it to become a kind of, you know, I envy us kind of conversation, but it's that kind of, you know, you go, like, I can't imagine being in a band where it's like, I mean, I suppose the world has changed as well. You know, there isn't that kind of record company of like, right, you know, it's going to be single album tour, blah, blah, blah. This is when we need the next album. It's got to be a bigger name producer. There's an upward trajectory that has to be adhered to and followed. And, you know, I do think, as fun as that ride can be, and it certainly is the first time round, it's exciting. It ends up sucking the life out of what you're actually trying to do. So I don't miss that aspect of it.
That is the dilemma. And you put that so succinctly in the book. I think it really, I found it was like an emotional ride, because you reminded me a lot of how it goes after the point that Lush stopped. You know, you described something where everything had changed. You were sensing that no matter what you did, it was just out of step somehow. And I was thinking, that's exactly the way we felt.
Yeah,
we would never express it, but we were just aware of it. We actually, when Susie and I and the band had stopped, and we thought, okay, we go to the Creatures now, because that's what we could do, just two of us. But it was like, is there anybody out there even interested? And so we were kind of just like, okay, we'll take an offer. We'll go on the road with John Cale, because we probably need him. But the opposite was kind of true. But it was just that. There was no kind of surety anymore. You have this like high rise, and everything's just escalating, strength to strength, the next hurdle. And then it was just that big game change somewhere. For us, it was early 90s. We were doing our last album as a band, and it was just that the record company was kind of pulling away, but not saying anything. And then for the first time, I remember we had like four people in the studio going like, where's the single? Right. And we'd never had that, you know.
Yeah. But it's a strange, you know, area that we've all operated in. It's like life without a safety net, you know. There is no, you know, gold watch at 60, you know, because you haven't done a great job, you know. It's just you go and buy your own stuff. When I did a tour in South America for my book, and you know, publishing companies are even worse than record companies. They are not going to pay anything, you know, tour support. That's not going to happen, right? So, you know, I thought, well, how am I going to fund my way around this place? And a couple of the better arts festivals said, well, we'll fly you down here and stuff, you know, and put you in a hotel. But then there's a couple of places I couldn't, you know, do anything. So we got this plan. I was like, okay, there's got to be a Cure cover band in every one of these towns that we're playing, you know. And so they sent me all like, YouTube videos of themselves, and I picked the one that looked like the most likely. And then I felt like Chuck Berry, you know. I said, I would turn up at this venue, never done the sound check, rehearsal, nothing, you know, and we just bash our way through five songs. And from doing that, you know, that paid for the whole tour. So,
oh, bless, that's brilliant. Oh, God,
it's very strange.
Mickey, is Justin in the band?
Justin is in, Justin's not in the band, in the little band, because like trying to drag a drum kit around. Sorry, drummers.
No, I know.
But it's a fucking pain in the ass. Yeah.
We just chose the wrong career, you know. The reason I wanted to be a drummer because it had so many bits. I liked all those bits and screws and nuts and bolts. I wanted to build things. Then I realised guitarists just put the guitar in the case.
I'm not being funny. I liked all the bits as well.
Yeah. You just put the guitar in the case and go to the bar.
I was very adept at putting up a drum kit, so... after years of touring with Chris, so
music stands and cymbal stands, not a lot of difference.
Yeah.
No, Justin, I remember, I fond memory of Justin when he was in Elastica. Same guy, right? Justin Welch.
Absolutely.
I went up to this rehearsal place in Camden Town, wherever it was. It wasn't Easy Hire, it wasn't John Henry's, it was the other one that was kind of new, and I was on my own because I was like trying to put the Creatures together. I had no crew. Just me, and I walked into the canteen, and Justin and the other guy who had just joined Elastica, who was from Manchester, I think he was the keyboard player with The Fall, and they both went, oh, we're not worthy. And I was going, eh? Who are these guys? And it was Justin. We met, they were trying desperately to do their second album, and it was just taking forever.
Oh, the difficult second album, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they had all sorts of madness going on in that band as well, you know. Nothing that I can really go on the record with saying, unfortunately.
No.
I sort of think with Elastica that it's such an interesting story, and I do wish one of them would write it all up, actually. I'd read that book, because I think it was so compressed, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yes, they played like small gigs, but for like 2 months, right? And then, you know, everything happened, like whatever happened in our kind of band trajectories, which might have taken a year or 2 years, or, you know, this is when we did this, this is when we did that, it was just compressed into the space of like 2 years, you know. From beginning to end, actually, you know, it was just insane. And of course no one can survive that, really. And I think they had, like, you know, some of it was absolutely amazing, but it was so fast that I think they struggled to survive it.
I just think we've all survived amazingly well.
Yeah, we're all got our marbles, more or less. So, yeah.
I mean, I do, you know, I don't know if, you know, what I really felt with a lot of that Britpop stuff, you know, about the machismo of it and all of that, which, again, I don't necessarily put down to the bands. You know, I'm not being funny, but if you actually... I don't know if you have met Blur. They're not a particularly macho band, you know what I mean? But I think that scene was kind of framed in a way that, you know, again, as a sort of press construct, they pull certain bits out of you and highlight them, and it tells like a just a shadow of a story, you know. And I think that certainly when you were both, you know, coming up, I'm not saying it wasn't problem free, but it had a different sort of, maybe less slick, that kind of marketing machine.
Right.
Because I felt with Britpop, it was, it to me, it still is just a press and, you know, kind of record company construct. That's who I see as the brains behind it all. I don't think those bands actually particularly even felt that way at the time,
right,
that they were part of some flag waving, you know. I know Blur have said that they wrote an album in response to that kind of American, you know, grunge invasion. But I think it was picked up and marketed by, you know, people to sort of emphasize that kind of, you know, cool Britannia stuff.
Right.
I don't think that was conceived of by any of the bands who were actually involved in it. And I think that, you know, the period that you, or certainly when I was listening to your music when I was growing up, it feels like a more innocent time in that it's more scattergun and less kind of controlled and packaged, if you know what I mean.
There was nothing controlled about what we did. I mean, yeah, people tried to, but we managed to avoid it mostly, you know. And so, yeah, you're right. It was a more innocent time in lots of ways.
As a band, we never had VIP meet and greet sessions. We never saw VIP packages.
No.
But, Mickey, you mentioned Soho House in London and probably the Groucho. I don't think I ever went to the Groucho, certainly not in the nighttime. But Soho House I have not fond memories of, because that was like a VIP meet and greet thing, if you like it, where you could watch people behaving badly, mostly male. Not a fun place.
I mean, I'll tell you what, so the attraction of it was when I used to go there, so 94-ish, pubs still shut at 11, you know what I mean? There came a point at London where everything was fucking closed, so the idea of being able to get a drink after 11 was quite attractive.
Yeah.
The fact that you had to spend it, you know, amongst a bunch of utter wankers was like a small price to pay.
Small price to pay, yes. I do recall later going down to Whitechapel, where around the corner from where, what's the guy's names? The two
Gilbert
artists.
And George.
Gilbert and George.
Go around to their local and hang out with the guys on the meat market. And,
all right, the market pub,
5 a.m.
Well, I do remember a place on Caledonian Road that was, I think, a kind of Turkish place that you could play pool. I do remember going there with, like, Spear of Destiny. I was just a fan, but they were going there, and I was like, oh, my God, it's Spear of Destiny. You're playing pool in the fucking Turkish bar in Caledonian Road. Yeah. Like, but so, yeah, I know what you mean. There's like, there were kind of, if you're in the know, there were like little places you could go. But trying to drag a sort of, and I'm not going to lie, most of the people I was hanging out with then wouldn't be seen dead somewhere like that. Like, if I suggested that, they'd be like, okay, no, like, we're going to go to the fancy Soho house where Simon Le Bon is playing the grand piano and whatever the fuck is going on. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I sort of, you know, the point is that I would go there and think, okay, fuck it, let's go, let's have a drink. But there was quite a who the fuck are you element to that place, you know, where, you know, I just felt like I don't want to be part of this elite, you know what I mean? And that place is full of people who want that and who emphasize that. And it kind of ruins the vibe, you know, because you either play the game, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you're, you know, that's the point of that place, is to be a kind of elite establishment. I mean, I'm sort of over-egging it a bit, but that's the kind of impression I got.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, because they have one here and it's the same thing here. But I always take that attitude that Groucho Marx had, you know, like, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member. you know. So if I always remember that, then it's okay. I can go to a few of those things and not get totally involved in it and not be upset by it either, you know.
See, I kind of agree to that to a point, right? I would say I'm very happy to be a member of a club that has me as a member, but not if they're only having me because they think I'm really fucking important and that's their right. reason for having yeah. me.
Yeah.
And I think that was just very much the time. I think there was a lot of drugs around as well. I'm not a big drug taker. I am going to tell you my Steve Severin drug anecdote.
Okay. Please.
This is just an example, right? I remember being, I don't know where it was. It might have been the club that you're talking about, right? But I remember I was standing there with Steve and Pam Hogg and he was like, do you want some Coke? And I was like, and Pam was like, yeah. And then I went to the toilets with Pam and she let me do all the stuff. Like I just tipped the whole lot onto a toilet. So I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, right? And I was trying to look like I did know what I was doing. And she was just standing there going, okay, maybe not tip the whole lot out. And I was like thinking, oh my God, like, can you just take over? Because I actually don't know what I'm doing, all right? Yeah. But in those situations, you have to pretend that you do know.
Yeah.
And there's this whole thing around drugs. Like, part of the reason why I have always been a boozer, partly because I could take it, but also because it's really simple, right? You go to the bar, you buy a fucking drink, and then you drink it. Drugs are just full of these pitfalls where you are going to get humiliated because you're not rolling it right, you're not chopping them out right.
It's the paraphernalia that surrounds it.
And people love that power. Like, they really fucking snidely remark on people not doing things right. And I just think I needed to go to like some sort of training course where they show you how to do all this stuff so I could emerge like a professional drug taker into the scene and actually like know how to jump through all those hoops, which I couldn't.
I used to be good at making a three skin joint or something, you know, because I would sit there all night with the bus drivers. You had bus drivers that would smoke as they were driving because, well, I thought it's better than having a beer, right? You know? And I'd be getting all the seeds out, rolling. I got really good at it. Little twist on the end. And there we go. Another one. Let's get off into the night.
There is a positive side to, you know, not knowing how to do any of those things is that you stay alive because a lot of people that do that stuff are dead.
That's true. I mean, to be honest, I think the truth is that drugs and like all drugs, including alcohol, just affect people in very, very different ways. And
sure.
I think part of the problem with those kind of like music scenes or whatever scene is that there's no acknowledgement of that, you know. It's all kind of, everyone's just treated the same, like, you know, and there's peer pressure to keep up.
Yeah.
I am not good with drugs. I have lost my mind so many times. I am the person sitting in the corner that people have to rescue because I'm like kind of weeping or like, I'm sitting there thinking, I think I need to go to the toilet, but have I just been to the toilet? Or do I need, like, I've completely lost all rational kind of ability.
Right.
And I kind of learned quite early on through, I think I had a bit of an, you know, experiences within the music industry where I suddenly thought, actually, I just can't do this. It's like, whatever, like, there's people wandering around who have taken twice what I've taken and they are functioning, right? And I'm just this sort of jello mess in the corner who is literally like having some sort of crisis, you know, and it's embarrassing. So I just had to sort of duck out from it. But you're right, it's a blessing in disguise because I did see people who got, you know, really destroyed by it. I mean, their characters completely changed.
We know too many people, right? We know too many people who are not here and people who, as you say, destroyed.
And I think the thing that I couldn't get over was how there were people I knew who were like really funny and interesting, and then they they'd be on drugs, and it was like they were like a shell of the person who they were.
Takes away a lot of people's personality.
But they seemed to think they were having a good time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. What? How does it do that? I don't know enough about it to understand it.
I mostly had a good time, but there were times when I wasn't having a good time, but I was hoping I was.
I think that's a good attitude for life, really, hoping we're having a good time, you know. One way or the other.
The lady I remember, and I don't know if you were friends at the time, was Debbie from Echo Belly. Debbie Smith?
I still see Debbie. She's great. I love her, yeah.
Oh, good, good. Because I think Debbie, every time I saw you, Debbie seemed to be around, and Debbie would always come up to me and say, Badgie, I'm going to be guitarist in your band, right? Me? Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. We're just, it's every time we met, I think. She's so wonderful, so lovely. I just remember with great affection I was a drinker, you know. That's the same thing. I going to the bathroom, the toilet, to chop them out was a waste of good drinking time. Going to the bar was a waste of drinking time. I could have three whilst I'm waiting for those two to be poured, you know.
Yeah.
I think my entire experience with drugs is just peer pressure. I think I did have a good time sometimes, but I think there was always a background sense of panic that and also like a massive price to pay. I just have the next 3 days were just appalling, so I just think you're either built for it or you're not.
That's right. I thought, well, we were always told that, you know, somebody told us that ladies never purchase them. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a good ploy. I don't think I'll ever buy them. If they're around, I may be indulged, but I'll buy a round of drinks, but no, not the others.
What do you mean ladies never purchase them?
I don't know. It's somebody who we all know probably said that just to...
Is that something that...
Is that an etiquette thing, or is it just because they're too fucking tight? I don't know.
No, it's... But I thought I'd adopt that for myself anyway, you know, that it's okay. As long as I don't buy them, then I know I'm not messed up, you know.
So you're like Bill Clinton. You had it, but you didn't inhale, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think Budgie might have inhaled, but...
Yeah. Couple of times.
I know. I could go on. I do remember a wonderful guitarist in a band. It's impossible. But we thought it was really good fun to be like on all fours inhaling exhaust fumes from, you know, passing vehicles.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how low. How low can you go? That's like down where the rubber is. You know?
That's low on so many levels.
Isn't it just particle... filters were not even invented
that's taken huffing to a new level, right? Yeah. Oh, blimey.
It did nothing for us, I tell you. Mind you, it's probably for where I grew up, you know. I felt at home down there.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Well, have we covered most of the topics, you think?
None. We haven't covered any of them.
No, I can listen. I can talk all fucking night. So, you know, you have to just stop me and say that people have shit to do, you know.
We'll say thank you very much, Mickey. It's been wonderful talking.
Yes, it has.
Thank you. It's been great.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.